tape was produced and distributed by Happy Trudge Audio in Roanoke, Virginia. Thank you for your purchase.
I'm Bill Hollingsworth, and I'm an alcoholic. And if some of you younger people want to know why somebody looks like I looked this morning down here talking, I tell you, it helps me. I'm not here to try to change anybody's thinking about drinking or not drinking, or to change their lives in any way, shape, fashion, or form. I just know from the very first time that I ever talked in front of an AA group, it helped me, and it's been helping me ever since. I'll tell you a little story that I had just heard that I told at the first AA meeting that I talked to. My father had a neighbor that had just told me a little story about a man that had always wanted a farm, and there was an old run-down place that come up for sale. None of the land much was tillable. It was full of rocks and stumps and bad. Wasn't very good. But he got out there and worked and hauled rock and load up stumps, hoed and plowed, and over a period of time, that farm was looking pretty good. So they had the preacher come to Sunday dinner. And the man was proud of his farm, and he wanted to show the preacher his crops. And they were good. They weren't big, but they were good. Everyone he'd show them the corn crop. And the preacher said, "Oh, you and God have done a wonderful job here." He showed him his garden, and it looked plenty of tomatoes and beans and stuff. And the preacher said, "Oh, you and God have done a wonderful job here." And he showed him another thing or two. And every time the preacher would say, "Oh, you and God have done a wonderful job here." And the man says, "Well, I want to tell you something. You ought to have seen this place when God had it by itself." That's been the story of my life. I'm one of the people who knew nothing about alcoholism. I had never heard the word. I had never heard the word alcoholic. And the last man that fired me for being drunk on the job told me there was a thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. I was born in Greenville, South Carolina, and as a little boy, my grandmother wanted to go up to the old home place to take care of her father in the last years of his life, and he was in his 90s, and this was a little bit before World War I. The first thing was in a very rural area. Of course, in those times, there was no roads, practically no automobiles, no electric lights, no indoor plumbing. I went to a little three-room country school up there. And my first remembrance of ever hearing anything about drinking, it wasn't referred to as alcohol. And these people were not talking to me, but I just overheard what they were saying, and they said that there were two things that man could do that were unforgivable. That if he did either one of them, he went to hell. One was if he took his own life, that was an unpardonable sin. And he went to hell for that. And the other was if he became a drunkard, it was unpardonable, and he went to hell for that. And of course, as a little boy, I thought, it went to hell. I thought they meant after you died, but I found out different. There was no drinking. See, along during this time when I was about 7 years old in 1918, they passed a law in Congress of the United States that there was going to be no more whiskey. No more nothing to drink. It was a problem because there were so many people. I don't think anybody had ever thought about alcoholism or that there was such a thing as an alcoholic. But there were certain people that were irresponsible. They drank. They couldn't take care of their families or didn't. They became a menace to society. So our national government was going to do with it, away with this thing that was causing all this trouble. So the 18th Amendment of Prohibition was passed at this time. To show you how smart them congressmen and senators were, they were people that never had drunk no liquor started drinking after they passed that law. And, of course, it got worse and worse and worse. Well, I thought that I would never drink. But it didn't cross my mind that I would. We moved to North Carolina in 1923, my father. My grandmother died in 22, and I had to leave the country affairs. So I went back home with my folks. We moved to Charlotte, and we were going into the Great Depression. It lasted up into the 30s. One of the first jobs I got was a job out on the passenger train of the Southern Railroad, selling soft drinks and candies and magazines and things of this nature, because during those days that was the mode of transportation. Wasn't any air transportation, and the buses were just big old overgrown automobiles, and the trains were the way people got from one place to the other. I got out there working. I was in my teens, and I began to hear about booze, and these were the ideas that came across to me. Whether this was what was said or not, I don't know. But this is what I heard people talking about how much fun it was to drink, how much, really one of the things I think that came across to me was that it was a very manly thing to do. It made a man out of it. In fact, I used to drink with an old Irishman down in Macon, Georgia, and he'd tell me, "Willie, ain't no such thing as strong whiskey. Just weak men." And I don't want to be weak. But it came across. It seemed that they had a big time. And one of the real tests of your manhood was if you could turn up a half-gallon jar of that corn liquor and take a big drink and chase it with a Chesterfield cigarette. Of course, it was burn you, and your eyes would get full of tears. You could feel the back of your neck, your hair going up like this. It'd take your breath, but as soon as you could speak, you say, "Ain't this good?" So I guess just overhearing about this stuff, and I think one of the things about us alcoholics is, in my experience, that we are people, it seems to be all of us are, that we want just a little bit more out of life than other people. We want to enjoy things. We music, the parties, just the fun of living. I think that's been my experience with most of the alcoholics I've come in contact with. And of course, that's just what I wanted. Well, of course, there was nothing but corn liquor in those days because prohibition, and it was in effect. You could buy about a dollar a gallon. There was no tax or anything on it. And of course, a lot of people would add different bootleggers would add different stuff to that to make it go further, to make more money. And we drunk a lot of stuff. We didn't know what the hell we was drinking. Somebody asked me something about when they was talking about the cigarettes here recently. And the federal government packaging and naming the ingredients, did they? What did they say about corn liquor? They didn't say nothing. Didn't nobody know what the hell it was. There wasn't no labels on it. You just drunk it. Made you feel good. First time I ever experienced drinking, the fellow was older than me. We worked for the same company, and he'd brought a half gallon of corn liquor in from Augusta, Georgia, and back in those days, whiskey from different places had the same thing after they started putting the brand on it. People like different brands, different types, but that Augusta whiskey had a good reputation being good stuff. They'd shake it up and the beads would come up around the top. Hell, I never knowed what the beads meant. Don't know today, but they'd shake it up. They'd say how good it was, how many beads was on it. Then this boy, had a room in an old hotel in Charlotte, an old flea bag hotel. He come in that night and he had a half a gallon with him, and we stopped by the pool room up there, and he invited a friend of his to come on up when he got off. And we went up, and I done had some drinks when this fella got there. In fact, I was drunk when he got there. But during those times, there are people sitting in this room that have seen them do it. I don't think they do it anymore. But you see, you didn't know what proof. You didn't know whether it was good or bad. But they had a way of testing it. They'd take some and they'd pour a little whiskey out on a surface and strike a match to it. And I think if it burned blue like a gas flame, that meant it was good stuff. It, all the impurities had been removed. In fact, it was really good for you. If it smoked like one of these diesel trucks out here, full of impurities in and make you sick, I have seen it put the match out. But I never have seen nobody say we ain't gonna drink it. We always drink it. I thought it was the foolishest thing I ever seen grown people do. Well, he is bragging about it, and he poured some out there on the old bureau. They called them bureaus, and flop house this was in. Most places had scarves, you know, linen scarves or something on the top. This one had newspaper on it. And when he poured it out and struck the match to it, he set the damn newspaper afire. And of course the wallpaper, it is tore, curled up. That caught fire. Whole damn room was on fire. I was over in the bed, and it was spinning around. One lamp hanging down, there's toting water from down the hall there, because we didn't have no running water in the room. We had a bowl and a pitcher set there. I puked. They finally got the fire put out, and I went to sleep, and I got up the next morning, and something happened that next morning. It was happened many, 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 many times in my life. I was sick. I was ashamed. I was remorseful. And with an experience like this, had I not been an alcoholic, I would think the chances were pretty good that I would have never taken another drink, because it had been no fun. But it didn't turn out that way. For some reason, wasn't too long till I drank again. And I got that glow that the alcoholics that are in this room this morning know about. That good feeling, the thing that was different from me that other people who drank. But after I took a drink, I wanted more. And it started causing me trouble before I was 19 years old. I lost my first job in 1929 as a result of being drunk on the job. I was 18 years old in 1929, and I had gotten fired before my birthday. And this was to follow me for a good many years of my life. And there was something else happened there that there was such a stigma attached to people who drank and drank to excess. We were talked about as no good, the weak-willed, no willpower, just worthless people who were really a menace to society. That's what, and the only treatment they really knew for it was to put you in jail. I would be so ashamed that when I'd get fired, I'd no longer want to stay in the little town or the town where I was, and I'd leave. And we read about that in the big book. They call it the geographical cure. We're running somewhere, think that we're going to find something different, that the world is going to be different. And I did that. I couldn't face up to these things, I couldn't face people, so I became a running drunk. One thing that I think today, and of course it absolutely makes no difference, because they told us when I first came in AA, it makes no difference what alcoholism is. The only thing is, do you want to do something about it? Dr. Silkworth at Town Hospital, the man that talked to Bill Wilson, had recognized that these people that were coming there to that drying out place, that really there was a sickness involved. They were different. And he pegged it just, there's never anybody to give any better explanation as far as I'm concerned, that this disease of alcoholism is a physical allergy of the body. And that if we take one drink, we want more. But he also said that people like us, we had a compulsion to drink that we had no control over. And in many cases, it became an obsession with us that we thought life without drinking, that we couldn't live. That we had to drink. That's what he told Bill Wilson. And this was really the message that Bill carried to Dr. Bob, which was the formation of this great fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's why you and I are here this morning. in this place together. It's where meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous are being held all over the world. I think we're into some 119 countries now from the beginning of that one simple message that we are allergic to alcohol. If we take a drink, we have to have more. What if everybody in the world that ever drank, all these people who can drink like they want to, when they want to, what if they're all like us? Damn, that'd be worse than Russia being over here. We'd tear the world up if everybody drank like we did. But there was that difference. I lost many jobs. I went a lot of places. When I look down and see these shoes this morning, I'm very grateful for them because I know what it's like to be without a pair of shoes. I know what it's like to be out on a night last night with no place to stay. I know what it's like to be unlovable. I know what it's like to live in fear and shame and remorse and resentment and hate. I know all about that because I experienced it and I lived it. In my case, a drink would change all this. It would make me feel better. The fear would leave, the resentment temporarily. I loved people temporarily. I felt like I was somebody, but it wouldn't last. The only way was to take another drink, and then the old squirrel cage. The alcohol physically made me very, very sick. Very, very sick. I'd get in terrible shapes. I've gone, I don't know, probably sometimes 3 weeks without eating any food. But I could drink. It's a baffling. It's very baffling. And yeah, that's in the book. And it's powerful. It's powerful because it kills people. And right this morning, while we're sitting here in this room with each other, there are people in insane asylums, there are people in penitentiaries, there are people that I would say not too far from where we're sitting here this morning that are hungover and sick, don't know what to do, don't know where to turn, and all they know is another drink. And this leads to complete destruction. I knew that. I never knew that. I just knew that there is the wind up, that little inner voice. This is killing you. Why did anybody have to tell me that it was killing me? I knew that. But there wasn't anything I could do about it. I'm kind of like an old boy in Charlotte. His doctor told him, this booze is slowly killing you. And he said, that's all right. I ain't in no hurry, no how. I can honestly say that I don't think that I ever tried to stop drinking. I tried all the way that I knew how to try or ever heard of to drink and not get so sick. I started that early. This was still during Prohibition. I was working at a hotel in Macon, Georgia. They had a employees party and we we was going out that night, and of course we had corn liquor and brandy. And they made home brew back in those days. There's no legal gear, so people just started making home brew. There was a nurse in the car with us, it was in our car that was going, and she said, what we need to do is stop and get some olive oil, and we'll all drink some olive oil, and said, then it kind of builds a base in your stomach, and you can drink more, and you won't get as sick and be as hung over. Well, she's a nurse. We thought she knew what she was talking about. So we stopped at the little grocery store. There wasn't no chain stores back in those days. And I see it at the grocery store now. It's Pompeian olive oil. And we got a little can of that, a bottle. And we killed it right there in the car. Went on to the party, and they had home brew, and I don't know what they're doing up in Virginia, but, you know, drunks, we're very creative. And in Georgia, at that time, people making home brew would put chicken manure in it so it'd work all faster, and you'd get there quicker. They'd put it in a little tobacco sack and stick it down in there. I guess there was some of that there that night, too. I don't know. But I rode back in a Rummel seat. And the next morning I got up and went to work. I was sick of the dog, but I swelled up. My jaw here laying down here on my chest. And if you think I look bad now, you ought to see me that morning. And I got to work, and the man said, my boss said, what's the matter you, Bill? I said, I don't know. He said, I was working in the food department. He said, you can't work around here looking like that. So he sent me back home. And, sent a doctor. I didn't have no doctor. Doctor come around and he looked at me and he said, you ever had the mumps? And I said, well, I don't know whether I have or not. And I didn't. I'd been gone home a lot. I didn't know whether I'd had the mumps or not. And I said, I really don't know, Doc. He said, how about mastoid? Well, I never had heard that word. I didn't know where you'd have mastoid if you had them. I said, not as I know of. And he said, well, you ever had this before? I said, I ain't never seen nothing like it before. He left. He didn't come back no more. I ain't drunk no olive oil no more. But I think probably one of the sickest things that I ever was of myself, I was in Atlanta in the 30s, and there was a lot of this bootleg liquor being sold there. Due to the fact prohibition had already been repealed, but the prices were higher than we could buy this moonshine for, and there was an epidemic in town, and they were finding people, it's a matter of record there in the Atlanta papers now, in the year 1938, that they were finding people dead, some of them were blind, some of them paralyzed, and it was a result of drinking this booze, whatever the man was putting in it, the wholesale bootlegger that was bringing it in. They caught him. He served several years' time in the Georgia State Penitentiary. But I was fired, no job, had to have a drink, get it anyway possible. And down below the old Grady Hospital, there was some bootleg joints down there, and we called them shooters. You could get about that much of that white liquor for 15 cents. And we'd go down there and get a shooter. And many a morning, we've been in there, knowing about all of this, the deaths, the paralysis, the blindness. We'd go in there and get a drink of that stuff and say under our breath, we hope this ain't it. I had come from a good home. And of course I believed in what I had heard, you know, that this was an unforgivable sin, that becoming a drunkard. And you talk about a low image of a human being, the way I felt about myself, to think that I had sunken to the depths of deprivation to drink whiskey like that. But I didn't know any different. And it's not whether we know any different or whether we don't. We always get the same results. I had never heard anything in my life that said what the 12 steps and the 12 traditions say. And I didn't know about that. But it made no difference whether I knew or whether I didn't. I had to pay the penalty. Oh. The things that were wrong with me and my allergy to alcohol. And the man that he had given me two chances on the job. I had a good job for my education. He hadn't fired me the first two times I was drunk, but he had told me, he said, Bill, this was a three hotels and this man owned out in one of them. He said, this happens again, I'll just have to fire you for taking my job. But in the meantime, he had told me about a man who had become the gutter drunk, as he referred to it, in Portland, Maine. Said he'd lost his business, his family. He'd just become the town drunk. But he said he got into a thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, and he said, you know, he recovered his business, his family, and most of all, his respect, because he'd lost all self-respect. And I sat and listened to that, and I thought, oh, God, I wish I could be like that. But I couldn't. I didn't have any idea when he was telling me that I could ever. But the morning came on a Sunday morning, and I was drunk, and he fired me. He had told me about this man. He didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous because he was not an alcoholic himself. But he thought that I should get in touch with him. And I went home and I did what I'd done for so many years. That last check I got, I spent it for booze and stayed in the bed drunk. Sunday, I got fired on Sunday morning, and on Thursday night, I had begged my wife to bring me one more pint so I might be able to sleep. You all know about that, sleeplessness and that drink that will make you go to sleep, and she brought it. And that was on Thursday night, of September the 29th, 1949. And I woke up on Friday morning. I didn't have any idea about quitting. I didn't know, but Bob Burdett just had this, got this article and had it bound and gave it to me for my last AA birthday. It was an article in Collier's Magazine about a recovery. And in 1949, this was not a violation of our traditions. This man said he had recovered in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he gave them the credit. we hadn't adopted our traditions at that time as part of our program. They were in existence. And I read that article that morning, and something changed. I had absolutely no credit for in any way, shape, fashion, or form. But I, as sick as I was, I still had $2, and either 5 or 10 cents. I could have got one more pint. But a power had already started work that I knew nothing about, and I didn't take a drink that day. On Monday, I called AA, and a man came. And my wife and baby and I, we were living at my father and mother's house. And he brought me the message of sobriety. And it took him less than 2 minutes to tell me. He said, "Bill, I haven't had a drink since May, 3 years ago." This was the first Monday night in October that year. And he said, "But the way we do it," said, "alcoholism is a disease." And he said, "The way I've been able to not drink is this morning I got up and asked God, as I understand him, to help me not take a drink today. Tonight," he said, "when I take my watch off and go to bed, I'll thank that same God for having been sober today." The first miracle, and I was not aware of this, but it happened. The miracle was the next morning, after he had told me that, I was willing to start doing what he said he had been doing. And I think willingness is the one door that all of us have to walk through to the road to recovery. I didn't have a God. I didn't know. But because David said that's what he did, that's what I started doing. And I'd like to say to you this year, this morning, that I had no idea that the miraculous things that did take place in my life after that message, and going to my first meeting the next night, and a man that never made this program, he said to me, he knew it was my first meeting, he said, "Bill, there's nobody here that can look down their nose at you. We're all the same." I've had some to you, my friends, that I've known for some time, know of some of the miracles that God has wrought in my life as a result of these spiritual principles that started between two people in Akron, Ohio in 1935. They're infallible. They always work. They don't work on rainy days or sunshiny days or in Roanoke or Rome, Alaska, Sydney, Australia. They work everywhere, every minute of every day. They're as sure as the law of gravity. If I don't hold on to that cap and drop it, it's going to hit the floor. So my purpose here this morning for me is to make me feel better. And a few years before Bill Wilson died, and Bill died the 24th of January 1971, somebody was telling him and bragging on him about, "You saved my life." And you know what Bill said? "Pass it on." And that's why I've been here this morning. If you believe in Alcoholics Anonymous and what it will do, pass it on. Thank you.